Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, March 4th, 2006. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. On March 2nd, just a couple days ago, Lyndon LaRouche gave a keynote at an EIR seminar in Berlin on the Iran crisis. The danger of global asymmetric warfare must be stopped. While the central matter under discussion was the escalating danger of Cheney and the neocons launching a preemptive military strike, possibly including nuclear weapons against Iran, LaRouche took the opportunity to discuss his role in the United States in mobilizing the Democrats in the Congress, along with some Republicans, to get rid of Cheney and to begin the process of rebuilding industry and infrastructure in the United States. The underlying issue, however, at the seminar was not Iran, or even the danger of an uncontrollable religious warfare being unleashed by a possible U.S. or Israeli attack, but the issue of leadership, how to challenge both the political leaders of a nation as well as the average citizen to get them to see what is in their real interest and that their real interest and the interest of their nation coincide. At the moment, as Lyndon LaRouche discussed, that means a policy of war avoidance. But for that to be successful, you have to adopt policies of economic development and cooperation to shape the next 50 years. Our guest today on the LaRouche Show is Jonathan Tenenbaum, who was the moderator of the seminar in Berlin, and Jonathan is also the author of numerous articles in the EIR on strategic affairs, especially those involving Russia. He's also a contributor frequently to 21st Century Science and Technology magazine. He's joining us from Berlin. We'll also be joined by our panel of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, and today we have with us Aaron Yule from Boston, Joelle Wright from Oakland, and Frank Mathis, who's actually from Boston but is with us in Los Angeles today. So, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Harley.
I'd like you to begin by giving our listeners a sense of the significance of the event in Berlin and the who was attending, and just give us a little bit of the idea of the context for this.
Well, I mean, things are very much on the edge. Yeah, of course, Iran was the titled subject of the seminar, and everybody's aware of the fact that we're running into, you know, we're running on a kind of a countdown in terms of events there that could, within a relatively short period of time, lead into an absolutely disastrous situation. At the same time, people were very much aware at the seminar of the fact that Cheney is on the edge. This had actually broken into the press. In fact, one of the participants mentioned that he had heard that maybe Cheney is leaving and maybe Cheney is going, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of sense of attention, a sense of that the world is really at a turning point at the seminar. We had a very good turnout in Berlin, a kind of a cross-section in terms of we had over 80 people, I think. We had 15 embassies, active representatives of foreign embassies here in Berlin. We had retired diplomats. That was a very interesting part of the audience. These were mainly retired German diplomatic people, many of whom are still, although they're officially retired from the diplomatic corps per se, are still very active, some of them traveling to Iran, into that region, very familiar with the situation. We had also some business people, some political representatives. We had also some journalists, some serious journalists for a change.
Well, Jonathan, this was one of a series. We've had a series of conferences and seminars in Berlin. It seems to me that the increased participation of Germans, including official Germans from institutions, is one of the changes. Is that accurate?
That's true. This was a kind of an extraordinary seminar. And we've had a series of dialogues with Lyndon LaRouche, bringing in people from Eastern Europe, from China, and so forth. Here, this seminar was organized kind of on an emergency basis to intervene also into this situation around Iran. And we made a special effort here in Berlin to draw in as much as possible also of the Berlin, let's say, audience, or Berlin is one of these cities in the world where world politics is made. And I think it was very significant from that standpoint, not just for Germany, but actually in terms of the echo we had. And also, what was extraordinary about this seminar, I think, was the depth of the dialogue and the controversy, that we got really to some very, very fundamental issues on the question of what is the United States particularly. That was one of the paradoxes of the seminar, is Iran was, you know, the nominal subject, and we did go into a lot of depth on the Iran crisis and everything around it, but the real center of the discussion was the question of the United States, the significance of the United States, and I think people got a very, very direct sense through Lynn's presentation and also through the discussion of the enormous responsibility that Lynn has personally in this situation, and which, more broadly speaking, people in the United States have. Because the United States, let's say the good people in the United States, the real Americans, are really carrying the ball in terms of bringing the world out of what could become a real disaster.
So we'll get more deeply into this seemingly paradoxical nature in just a moment. I want to alert our listeners that we will be taking email questions, and you can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And you can address your questions to Jonathan Tenenbaum or anyone on our panel. You mentioned at the outset that things are on the edge with Iran. Well, on Monday, El-Baradei is supposed to release the report of the International Atomic Energy Agency. We know that UN Ambassador John Bolton is frothing at the mouth to get something into the UN Security Council. There were the meetings, the emergency meetings, both in Moscow between the Iranian representatives and Russian officials trying to work out a compromise. I think yesterday it was in Vienna, the EU3 met with Larijani, the Iranian representative. What's the latest on the countdown toward the efforts to move this into the UN Security Council?
I don't have a last-minute bulletin on this. I think that what should be emphasized on this is that, the headlines in the radio and television and the newspapers are not necessarily reflecting what the real issues are and what's really going on. I mean, Lynn emphasized, of course, very strongly, he said, get Cheney out. That on the one side, and this was also underlined by Jürgen Hübschen, the former German military attaché to Baghdad, and a very experienced person, also by other speakers there who were real experts on the region, together with LaRouche emphasized, if there's a military attack on Iran, and this is what the neocons and the people behind them, and the British particularly, are planning what they want to do. If such an attack occurs on Iran, then as Lynn said, there's no bottom on this. That's to say, we are then on the way into, I mean, literally, all hell will break loose. This is not like the Iraq thing. This means religious war, the unleashing of religious war worldwide. So Lynn emphasized, get Cheney out. And the Cheney is on the edge, and that's the only way to make the world safe. That doesn't do the job completely, but that would be crucial to making this situation manageable.
I found one of the fascinating things about the discussion was that there were a number of people, including, I think, journalists, asking Mr. LaRouche, what would be the trigger of the war with Iran? Is it going to the euro? Is it the oil? And I thought this was where Lynn made some very interesting points. How did he answer this question of why war with Iran?
He emphasized repeatedly, and this was also seconded by Hübschen and some others, that actually Iran per se has nothing whatsoever to do with the war danger. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's happening in Iran. that what we're dealing here is a policy for, Lynn said, it's actually the globalization policy. That is to say that you're dealing with a global force. It's not the United States. It's not even, let's say, the British in some general sense. It's a global force, oligarchical force, which is out to destroy civilization as we know it. That was very difficult for people to really understand. It was one of the things in the discussion going back and forth.
It kept coming up.
Yeah. And there was a real struggle, actually, in the discussion, and I know this from talking to many, many people, for people to somehow come to grips with this kind of reality.
Well, John, let's take that question then. This, what Lynn insists is that you have to understand that this oligarchy, this financial oligarchy, is committed to a policy of permanent war, permanent revolution. Why is that the case? Why is that necessarily the case that they need that?
Well, Lynn, one of the things he said, I recall, he said, look, don't look for a rational explanation. I mean, let's say an explanation like, well, they want to get oil revenues, or, well, they want to control this or that resource. But this is the chaos faction.
Mm-hmm.
That they are committed strategically, not for a rational reason, not for some narrow concept of interest, but this is a historical current in history. You go to Venice, you go to the Persian Empire, you go to the Roman Empire, you go to the British Empire, and it's a way of thinking, and it's absolutely committed to the destruction of nation states and to a global change, and you can't understand it except in historical terms, which of course people don't tend to do, and people had a lot of trouble. That was part of the paradox, is to grasp this thing. And on the one side, and this is the way it's often seen from Europeans or by Europeans, is they see here you have a U.S. administration, U.S. They agree, yes, it's not the whole United States, but it's the elected government, or more or less elected government, and that the U.S. is doing this or that. On the other side, and this is a paradox, Lynn was hammering on this, and people do have a certain sense of this, that the United States is key to solving the world crisis, and specifically the world economic and financial crisis. So how to get an idea? Where are the bad guys? No. What's the enemy? And Lynn said, don't look for a nation that's the enemy. That the enemy is a global force, which, and that's where you people have real trouble to understand it. How could you have people that would consciously act to draw the world into a period of chaos and religious war? Certainly, it can't be a nation, because the nations are going to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, a force that has the sense of, has the active sense of desiring to destroy governments, national governments around the world, from the standpoint, and then Lynn identified this force, and particularly pointing to what he called the bankers, and the circles behind this faction, which controls through central banks basically the nations of Europe, that basically sets policy to a large extent, has the notion that actually the governments, to the extent that they're tolerated, are by these guys thought of as basically kind of lackeys or the administrators of policies that they set. And now we're going in the context, Lynn actually, in his opening remarks, put the world financial collapse, the coming collapse, in the center point, and said, "Well, that's what the name of the game is." And these circles are reacting to that and playing with that.
I'd like to explore this just a little bit more before we bring the LaRouche Youth Movement panel in, because this is also the kind of problem that people in the United States have in organizing, because On the one hand, people want a simple explanation, and it's not that simple, but once you actually understand the difference between the American system and this imperial British system, it becomes much more simple. How do you see from Europe, do people get this idea that there is a difference between the American system, the FDR idea of a credit system as opposed to a central banking monetary system, and how that's related to the drive for chaos?
This is a very tricky and very tricky business. I would say it's tough because this has become embedded. I mean, in the period of the Cold War, if you take Berlin, for example, I mean, West Berlin, when Kennedy came to West Berlin and said, "Ich bin ein Berliner," and, I mean, still, if you go to the place where he made that speech, people all remember it, and there was a certain kind of very close connection, also the role of the United States in liberating Europe, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But
and the Berlin Airlift.
Absolutely. So in Berlin, there is a lot of a sense, in the older people particularly, a positive sense of the United States. However, you have, of course, generation changes, and you have the effect of the Bush administration and so forth. And you have also, and this came up very strongly in the conference, in the seminar and the discussion, a kind of distancing, a notion of a so-called European identity. For example, the so-called Constitution of the European Union, which thankfully was rejected by the French population in a referendum, but they're still pushing for this. This is a so-called Constitution of the European Union, which is longer than 500 pages, which is just, for an American, there you see a difference. The fact that there was not an uproar against this is showing that there's a really more deep-seated problem, which has not really been made conscious. I mean, LaRouche and I myself and our colleagues here have been working on this a lot, and it came out very clearly. For example, the notion of parliamentary democracy, and the notion, what is democracy? Because it is unfortunately the case that although you have parliaments, which are elected and so forth, people do not really have a sense, I think you can say in Europe generally, that actually it's government by the people, for the people, and of the people. They don't have that sense. They have a sense of being representative, having a word, putting a word in. But there's nothing like the concept of the Senate, the concept of advice and consent, the concept of a real discussion in the population on the fundamental issues of policy. And this reflects on the underlying arrangement where you have these central banks, banking system, which very literally dictates policy. And so you have a dual system, and it's not simply the formal aspect of it, but it's also the fact that people internalize, even if they're not completely aware of it, the notion that, well, you have governments, but they're kind of like administrators. They're not actually setting a mission the way Franklin Roosevelt said it, the way even Kennedy set a mission in the case of the space program, but rather they're administering things. And then you have the so-called reality, which people very much associate with money, which the governments have nothing to do with. So it's a very, very deep thing, and it came out actually in one exchange with LaRouche, which I might just throw in here at this point, because I think it was a kind of a turning point in the discussion, where one of the participants, who is actually a former member of the German Parliament, quite experienced politician, who reacted to some things that Lyndon LaRouche was saying, and also to I had shown to the audience the Children of Satan pamphlet series, and brought out that the LaRouche youth movement had put out millions of these all over the United States, in Washington in particular, and brought this into the Congress and so forth. So this fellow said, well, the problem with the United States, he said, and it was very sincerely stated by him.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the United States is that Americans and the United States system or political tradition mixes up morality and law.
Mm-hmm.
Mixes up the sense, the concept of morality and the concept of right. Whereas in Europe, these are separated. You have to separate morality and law, because there's no absolute truth. The views, dominating views, change with time. Everything changes. So therefore, you cannot say this is absolutely true. You can't talk about principles, but you need rules. You need rules, a sense of for behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Rules as opposed to principles.
And how did Lynn answer that?
Well, he said, this is exactly what sophism is. This is sophism, exactly this assertion. There's no truth. This is, he said, this is exactly the sophism that destroyed the Greek culture and which is destroying us now. And Lynn said, look, if you eliminate the notion of truth, then you have nothing. Then you have tyranny. And Lynn said, look, but universal principles exist, like gravitation, in the sense of Kepler's discovery of a universal principle of gravitation, which exists. And Lynn said, of course, you have further discoveries. In a sense, there's a modification of human knowledge as new discoveries of principle are integrated, are made. Nevertheless, however, the concept, the principle, still remains. And Lynn said that actually, without the concept of truth and discoverable universal principles, there's no basis for having peace at all. You can't have a dialogue of civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, let me ask you on this topic, and we're starting to get some emails in. You're listening to Jonathan Tenenbaum, who was the moderator of the EIR seminar in Berlin last week. We will take your email questions. Send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com, and we'll get to those questions shortly. It must be quite tangible now, this idea of a clash of civilizations in Europe, given the recent developments around the cartoon, the scandal of the cartoon, the riots, the demonstrations, the near civil war situation that's been provoked in Iraq following the attack on the Shia mosque. These things are probably very much in conscious in the minds of people. To what extent do you think there's a recognition that this is a policy which is being deliberately provoked as opposed to some natural animosity or differences between religious doctrines?
I think there's a big, great differences depending on who you talk to and how much access those people have to some knowledge of what's going on in the world. People who are former diplomats, who are involved in world affairs, they unless they're ideologues themselves, tend to have an idea or a sense that there's something going on here, that we're being driven in a certain direction. They may not. I've brought that into numerous discussions here, what the EIR, the story of the EIR got out about what was the actual specific deliberate provocation of this, the cartoons, who did it, and so on and so forth. And it's, nobody basically will contradict it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain fear in the population. I have the sense, though, that the kind of hype that may be going on in the United States, I actually don't know, is not so strong in the media here. I think, in fact, my own sense here in Europe, at least in Germany, is that it's people would tend to not take seriously enough what the implications would be or how close we are to a potential religious war.
Mm-hmm.
So those people who have a sense of it they're so horrified that they're just basically praying that this is not going to happen.
That's quite important to stress, because it is clear from what is being unleashed that you could easily have something that would be blown out of control if the situation continues in Iraq or Iran.
You have a large, I mean, take Berlin, for example. You have a large Muslim population in Berlin, in Germany, in Aachen, in France, and so forth. And there, actually, Helga Sepp-LaRouche, in her presentation on the Dialogue of Civilizations at the seminar, emphasized this question. You have an economic problem to integrate these people. Many of them are integrated fully, but you had a problem of the economic crisis, as you saw, for example, in France with Sarkozy, mm-hmm. the interior minister, who wants to become a real neocon, a real dangerous type,
mm-hmm.
Who is actually very deliberately playing on race, on the race issue, and making inflammatory statements. But on the background, that's where you do have a certain problem of the economic crisis, with unprecedented levels of unemployment, officially in Berlin of 19%, actually higher.
Wow.
In some areas of France and so forth, very, very high unemployment, of course, especially high among many of these immigrant populations. So you do have a problem. It has nothing to do with religion per se. But if you have a religious war triggered, something that makes the parts of the population really enraged, then you have an explosive problem. That's why people who are more on the inside of European governments, well-meaning people, are really scared and do have a sense that if an Iran military attack takes place, then we're really in trouble.
And do you think that we have about a minute and a half before we take a break, do you think that the Europeans are hoping that something can be successfully worked out between Russia and Iran to avert this crisis this week?
Certainly. And Lynn LaRouche also said this is the immediate option. Is the Europeans are not only hoping, but they're also, at least the more responsible of them, are also working in that direction together with the Russians. And the Russian proposal and the Russian intervention is really the going thing in terms of cooling down this crisis.
And the British, on the other hand, seem to be intent on blowing it up.
Yeah, and also in ways that are, again, not necessarily so apparent to people, because as usual, the British are playing all sides at once.
Well, there's been some
that very much.
There's been some excellent material in recent EIRs on the background of this, including the importance of the Sykes-Picot-style diplomacy that takes us back to the beginning of the century and the British manipulation leading into World War I and then in the immediate post-war period. So we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back with Jonathan Tenenbaum and the LaRouche Youth Movement panel. This is the LaRouche Show. It's live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. It is also archived, so if you miss it or if you wish to play it for your friends, you can find it on the LaRouchePub.com site, where it's available, and there's a whole archive for the last 3 or 4 years of shows that, I think if you go back a couple of years and look at what we've been discussing on this show, you'll find a very clear forecasting capability, which is associated with the founder of the EIR, Lyndon LaRouche, Jr. If you wish to get some literature to circulate, you can call us at 888-347-3258. Jonathan mentioned the pamphlet, The Children of Satan 4. That's still available. We are coming out with a pamphlet from the recent webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, and we also have now in circulation LaRouche's Prolegomena for a Democratic Platform, The Legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And this is going to be an essential feature of the kind of fight and change we need in the Democratic Party. You can get that literature by calling 888-347-3258. And while you're calling, you should make a contribution so that we can fund the activity of the LaRouche Youth Movement in getting this literature out throughout Washington, D.C., and the rest of the United States. So we are back with our show. I'd like to bring in now Frank Mathis from Los Angeles, who's been patiently listening to the discussion. Frank, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I guess I could say something. I know in terms of sheer power of organizing, the LaRouche Youth Movement, because of LaRouche's ideas and because of specific things that have been being brought up, Jonathan said some things on this idea of the difference between the American system and every other system, that there's a misunderstanding of principle and of actual truth in governing a human population that has a creative mind. So I know out on the West Coast, there's been a huge drive. It's sort of been, I guess you could say, reorganized around what is going to be, at the end of April, the State Democratic Convention, which, California being the hugest state, is going to be the hugest Democratic Convention before the 2006 midterm elections. So we've reorganized ourselves specifically around studying in depth a lot of LaRouche's latest economic works, and then looking back on some older things that he's brought up in terms of Riemann and really getting into this idea of economics so that we can present as a youth movement, as a force, with a unity of effect, LaRouche's program directly to important parts of the Democratic Party. Feinstein from California, who else? Barbara Boxer is from California. So I know the entire sort of power of the organizing has been around that, and we've been making some breakthroughs in just street organizing and also raising funds to fund what we're going to be doing at the end of April, which hopefully will have around 200 youth coming from here, Houston, Oakland, and Seattle. So I just think whoever out there who's listening to this and hasn't read LaRouche's latest platform, you should read it because it really lays out what we're going to be doing leading up to April here on the West Coast specifically, but just in general, 2006 in November.
Okay. Jonathan, I saw in the report today in the briefing that one of the journalists who asked the question of Lynn said that he or she was organized at the event by an encounter with a LaRouche youth member, apparently on the streets of Berlin. We have a very active and aggressive LaRouche youth movement in Berlin. How is that going right now?
I think it's going excellently. We had actually additional organizers here. We had some power organizing with multiple book tables on the streets. I mean, we have the youth movement in Berlin has a presence in this city, which is really extremely strong. And we're actually going into an election campaign in September. So we have a situation where basically everybody in the city has seen our organizers. We had also a good attendance representation from the youth movement at the seminar. We have often people that we meet in ministries and have gotten leaflets and so forth. So we have a potential here, rather concentrated potential, of really having a very, very powerful movement right here in the capital city of Germany, together with our Saxony campaign, where we just had the mayoral campaign in Leipzig. And I think it's really in a breakout situation here. I should say, by the way, that I cannot overemphasize, because I often use that in discussions with people here. It makes a very, very big difference when people here in Europe know that what the LIM is doing, what the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing in the United States, and particularly that we're in the Democratic Party, that we are shaping the Democratic Party directly in a way which reflects also what the essence of the American so-called system is, the American political tradition is. And this is not something of just some sort of elections, but this is the active, a mass movement of people saying we are determining the policy. We're going to discuss the policy, the fundamental issues of policy. So there's a very big remoralizing effect of people seeing the LaRouche Youth Movement on the streets of Berlin of realizing this is part of a movement which is shaping United States policy, which is right there in the Democratic Party, in the Congress, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the most powerful things. I also, in my last trip to Russia, or I met people in the Duma, people in institutes and so forth, and it was very, very important for them to get a sense, a hands-on sense, that there's a real political fight in the United States, and they get very excited about it.
You may be interested in hearing, Jonathan, that I think some of the people that you know in Moscow who are visiting the United States to look at the question of education,
mm-hmm.
are coming to our office in Los Angeles this Tuesday to meet with the members of the youth movement and actually film some of their educational work to bring back to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go over to the other side of the country, to the far east coast from Boston, and hear from LaRouche Youth Movement member Aaron Yule. Aaron, what do you have to say for yourself today?
Well, in terms of what we're doing here in Boston, we started organizing in the streets around the work we've been doing on Johannes Kepler's Mysterium Cosmographicum, where he derives the platonic solids and develops the relationships among platonic solids, which we've been bringing out into the streets to get into an actual in-depth discussion on the science driver program for the United States and how we have to integrate into the population actual cultural change through these great concepts in history that have led to this nation we have today. So we've been doing that. It's been a lot of fun actually going to Harvard Square, the center of a lot of sophism that you see from Harvard students and the general faculty, and getting them to actually be challenged on a concept, on a truthful concept of something that exists in the universe and not in their theories and such. So we've been integrating into that, and it's been pretty successful here.
Aaron, if I'm not mistaken, didn't you have an encounter with one of the high priests of sophistry in the United States recently?
Yeah. When we were down in Washington, we ran into Scalia, who's probably a modern-day Thrasymachus in his own right.
Probably not as bright as Thrasymachus.
No, he's not really. it was funny though, because he has this thing against natural law. He thinks it's whatever people believe, and that the founding fathers had this like mystical, you know, realization that there's some unbelievable force, like maybe Adam Smith's invisible hand or something. And so he was saying like that. You can't use natural law, the kind of idea of natural law, because it's a personal idea.
Right, and gravitation is just a personal opinion.
Yeah, right.
Well, Aaron, you mentioned this question of taking Kepler out into the field. I think if you think about what Jonathan was saying was one of the central issues of the Berlin Conference, this discussion of where do physical principles fit into statecraft, this to me is one of the most compelling dramatic aspects of what we do with the LaRouche Youth Movement, the work on Gauss, the work on Johann Sebastian Bach's Jesu meine Freude, and taking these moments of scientific discovery and cultural discovery and showing people that these are not something in the past, but they actually have to be part of the dialogue at the present. Why don't you just give us a little sense of when you say you take Kepler out onto the street, how do you do that?
Well, we go out, we set up a big amount of tables, and we start constructing the stuff he lays out in his works, in Kepler's works. And, you know, people walk over and say, what are you guys doing?
It's a legitimate question.
and we're saying we're forming a platform for the Democratic Party. On the basis of actually knowing something versus believing it. Because it's funny, because a lot of these students, like at Boston University, Northeastern, and stuff, they say, I like Kepler, like you had a physicist, we had a couple of physicists at BU say, oh, I love Kepler. And we're like, oh, yeah, have you read anything by Kepler? No. Okay, so how do you actually know what Kepler's mind was and what kind of discoveries he actually made? And what the benefit was for society. So we're taking that sort of approach on going out there and setting up and building things with people, constructing the like his spherical stuff on the divisions of the sphere and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, also we have with us today from Oakland a veteran of some campaigns against Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is involved as well in taking these ideas directly into the Democratic Party. Joelle, what do you have for us today? Do you have any questions or comments?
Yeah, I do. I have a question, sort of. It's recently Lynn, in this last webcast, was talking about how Iran has the right to a full nuclear cycle, which is like the total opposite of what the whole Cheney guys are. You know, they think that if you're Muslim, then you're prone to blow up things, so you shouldn't have anything that is explosive. But I was thinking about some of the history that Lynn was going through in the Prolegomena and that he's gone through before when he was talking about how Bertrand Russell was trying to build up this the United States to have a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union, or at least try to scare them to think that that might be possible. And he was saying something about how usually in a war, you know, somebody has to win. And if you have, you know, two nations or one nation, the other side is, you know, threatening the war, but the other side, they actually have the weapons to be able to blow up the other people who want the war, that would kind of, you know, squelch that drive to do something like that. And so, like, right now I was thinking, like, even if the Russian negotiations go through and Iran does have their uranium enriched inside of Russia, that we don't know if that's going to stop a conflict, an attack on Iran from Dick Cheney. And is it a lot more people have nuclear weapons than they did when Russell was trying to organize this conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States. And so we are looking at a situation where, you know, a large portion of the planet could be wiped out by a nuclear conflict between multiple nations, not just Iran, who so far we don't know actually has any nuclear weapons. But is this what Lynn meant when he was talking about how the synarchists and the people who are driving this war can't win, but we can lose? Humanity can lose.
Well, Jonathan, just to pull that all together, this idea of non-proliferation, can that stop war? Why don't you comment on the what mm-hmm. Joelle just presented?
Look, I would just say one thing that what can wipe out civilization is not nuclear weapons, but it's religious warfare. Religious warfare is like a million times more dangerous. I mean, a religious war in the sense of the 30 Years' War, the Crusades, a million times more dangerous than nuclear weapons. Whether people, of course, there's a danger nuclear weapons might be used. People can kill themselves off, kill each other off with knives, with stones. So that you're looking at something that where the real danger is located. You do have a danger of nuclear weapons being used, but the real danger is located in this policy, of which one component is the notion of permanent warfare, and particularly now the worst form of permanent warfare, which is that involving religion, the unleashing of a particular kind of fanaticism and hatred, which can, you know, burn for a century maybe or longer. And on the other side, and this gets to the what you all brought up with the Russell policy. If you look at Russell, he laid out this concept of destroying sovereign nation states, eliminating national sovereignty, and eliminating scientific and technological progress, which, as anyone who knows the U.S. system, the American system, they are inseparable. The notion of a nation state, a Republican nation state, and the notion of scientific and technological progress are one and the same thing, really, if you understand it. So that and Russell made this argument, you see, science and technology is dangerous. It led to the bomb, although he was the one himself who demanded that the bomb be used against the Soviet Union, before the Soviets had one, making this argument. Therefore, since science and technology is so dangerous, it should be basically eliminated. Only a world government would have a certain control. Maybe the world government would have nuclear weapons. Now we're in the even the extreme form of Russell, where the present policy of the chaos faction, which is not just British, it includes families in Europe, it includes people in different places, where they're not even looking at a world government right now. They're looking at just chaos. But now, when we go to this whole discussion about proliferation, the question of what nations should be allowed to have what, does go back to Russell, mm-hmm. And it's just the wrong approach. Lynn said very clearly, he said, look, the NPT, the non-proliferation treaty, just forget it. This doesn't solve anything.
In fact, the argument that Lynn makes is that it's the suppression of the sovereign right to the development of science and technology, technological and scientific progress, which is much more the cause for war.
Yeah, and he emphasized very strongly, we cannot have a world economy without nuclear energy now. We need nuclear energy. If we don't have nuclear energy, we can't have a peaceful world economy. And I would say also, I've emphasize this in a book I wrote about the history of nuclear energy, that if you look at where nuclear energy comes from, it's inseparable from the development of productive power or the productive powers of labor, and particularly from the development which led into the discovery of the periodic system of elements by Mendeleev. And now it's like you would say, therefore, you can't just say, okay, you're allowed to use oxygen and hydrogen and iron, but you're not allowed to use uranium in your economy. In other words, these elements of the periodic system are banned. It would be like saying you can have, among the regular solids, you can have the tetrahedron and the cube, but you're not allowed to have the icosahedron. You can't do that because the periodic system is a single system. It's a single process, universal physical process. So if you deny to a nation the knowledge and the capability to develop its economy in the system of physical principles which exist, then the nation can't develop. So that's one of the reasons why the anti-nuclear movement was unleashed, particularly in the baby boomer generation, using the terror by the baby boomers of war and of nuclear and so forth.
With a key role played by Bertrand Russell.
Absolutely. So in order to get a kind of battering ram against the notion of scientific and technological progress and to get people, to drive people anxiety-ridden into this culture of sophism, which we have today.
We have just under 12 minutes left, and I want to get a couple of the emails in and see if we can get a little more from the LaRouche Youth Movement. So, Jonathan, I'm bringing up a question that was sent in by Eugene Jaffe. His question is, what kind of resonance do you get from the science professors and others on science as a driver to the economy?
Well, I think this is... This is going to take off in the period, particularly here in Germany, in Berlin, where we're going to have, I think, a very exciting election campaign, a very exciting process going into the election campaign, particularly with the youth on this. A key driving theme of this election campaign is going to be the reindustrialization of Berlin based on the science and technology of the 21st century. And one key component of that is going to be such things as cooperation with the United States, with other nations, on a Moon-Mars project. Another component is going to be the renaissance of nuclear energy. As you may know, Germany had one of the world's most advanced nuclear power industries, an industry which was producing high-quality nuclear reactors for energy production and exporting them all over the world. In fact, the nuclear reactor in Iran, in Bushehr, that was originally a German project.
Mm-hmm.
So there's now a growing excitement on the and I should know I should just say that unfortunately, under the influence of the Greens, so-called environmentalists, Germany has completely dismantled its nuclear program. So the technologies that were developed in Germany, in particular the high-temperature reactor, are now shut down in Germany, and they're being carried forward in China and in South Africa. So there is, however, one very, very interesting argument that I'm having with people here, which does bear on this on the notion of the American system, and that is the case of the Kennedy space program. In its significance, not just as a thing in itself, but as an expression of something which is not well grasped in Europe, because of what I mentioned. I mean, this question of the separation between morality and rules, difference between the United States system, Republican system, of the Federalist Papers of Lincoln on the one side and so-called more liberal-style parliamentary democracy, the difference between a monetary system and a credit system, monetary system thought of as some sort of a oil of Lagrange set of rules of manipulating with money, as opposed to a notion of developing a nation through credit. So this comes out in the discussion on a space program and the notion of a science driver. Because a science driver is not a market economy measure.
Mm-hmm.
A science driver is a command decision, or at least a command commitment, to drive through a set of policies an acceleration of scientific and technological progress, in a sense, unnatural from the standpoint of the market economy, very natural from the standpoint of human beings. Mm-hmm. So you have a European space program, which does very interesting things, like the Mars Explorer. It does a lot of planetary missions. But the scale of the program is kept below the threshold of having the kind of multiplier effect, the kind of science driver effect, which the Kennedy program had in the United States. It's kept an order of magnitude too small. So it's not only that people don't necessarily understand this principle, but there's, like the fellow that was intervening and thought he was representing the so-called European culture,
mm-hmm.
and rejecting the notion of universal truth, in contradiction to Leibniz, by the way.
Yeah.
Just like, it's not simply they don't understand the science driver, but many people actually reject the idea. But others are very excited about it, which is why I think that it will be very, very crucial if you get some positive breaks in the United States on this, then things will really be turned loose in Europe. Anything positive that happens in the United States has an enormous effect here in Europe, as long as we're on the scene.
You're listening to Jonathan Tenenbaum. This is the LaRouche Show for March 4th, 2006. What Jonathan is just discussing is what's being unleashed by Lyndon LaRouche with his release of a new platform for the Democratic Party, or I should say an extended preface. You can get that by calling us at 888-347-3258, and you should be distributing that wherever you are. Now, we have just over 6.5 minutes. I'd like to go back through our panel again to see if there are some quick questions you can fire at Jonathan. Frank, you want to start?
Yeah, I have a quick question. I think it's really interesting that this idea of morals and law keeps on coming up, because what you have, and maybe John or Harley can comment on this, but what you've had in, I guess, throughout history, and this really gets at the idea that the oligarchy hasn't really employed any new methods, was that you've had a Socratic dialogue that's always the idea of a Socratic dialogue, which has always posed a danger to the oligarchy. And I guess in the Middle Ages, it was sort of expressed through these three monotheistic religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, which I guess gives an insight into why it was these three religions which were always attacked and pitted against each other. But you realized also with the inception of the United States, you look at things like the Federalist Papers and how Hamilton was organizing New York through a Socratic dialogue. our government was the first government in history to be based on that, an actual Socratic dialogue between, you could say, three different branches and also the population.
Well, Frank, I'm going to cut you off for the sake of other people. I think you answered your own question.
All right.
Jonathan, there's a question that was just emailed in from the Detroit office. Isn't population reduction the fundamental goal of the oligarchy?
I don't think it's anything simple like that. No? I think it's the same kind of problem, it's a kind of notion of a world. It's not any specific thing. Maybe it would be a little bit. So the trouble is, look at what's happening in your mind when you try to fasten on to one thing, sort of for the purpose of giving a simple explanation. I mean, Lynn LaRouche has an uncanny and powerful ability, which he's worked on, of course, over many years, to actually see, in the metaphorical sense of see, the mind, the oligarchical mind. And that's what you have to understand. It's challenging.
Yeah. Aaron, you have a final question?
Yeah, I do. In terms of the International Monetary Fund and how LaRouche talked about taking it back into receivership and putting it into some kind of international development bank, I was wondering if you could comment on how that would work.
Okay.
I think that's... Lynn kept referring to is that we in the United States, we can do this kind of thing. We can take not just the IMF. The IMF is kind of is not really the issue. It's the world financial system. We're going to put the world financial system into receivership, and the United States will take the initiative. It's not a formal, affair. It's asserting actually a universal principle against a bankrupt, pseudo-formal, oil-of-the-grange-type system. The difficulty here is exactly that, I know Lynn's been writing on this, on the question economics is not a game.
Mm-hmm.
Is the notion of what is an idea, what is a principle as opposed to a rule, or to a set of rules, or to a so-called system? We have to assert what Lynn calls a credit system. Credit does not mean loaning out money, although that's part of it.
It's not a credit card system.
Not a credit card system. It means a commitment to creating wealth, a commitment to developing the human race on a long-term basis. That's what, and a commitment which is based on a knowledge of principle. So that can only be asserted among the world's nations at this point by the United States. For that, the United States has to get back to that.
That's why the platform is subheaded FDR's Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
We're down to 2 minutes. Joelle, do you have a quick question for Jonathan?
Well, I was just thinking about, this organizing that we're doing here in California and how really, some of the only, competent people that I really see are the members of the LaRouche Youth Movement and people who work with LaRouche. And so we have an election coming up in 2006, and also in 2008, and I'm just wondering what you thought about, since we're not running anybody right now that I know of, what you thought about the potential of us actually influencing the leadership that we have to make them better.
Okay, Jonathan, we are influencing and moving leaders. How do we expand on that?
Mass organizing of what Lynn has been hammering on, particularly here in Europe, this going to the population, actually doing what is not – you can go to some so-called elite person and explain to them something about Kepler and so forth. But if that person – they may not understand – but if that person knows you're going out in the streets and you're organizing a mass movement on the basis of getting people involved in fundamental ideas, that's a totally different kettle of fish. And I think it's that interplay – we're building a mass movement. We're turning around the United States in the sense of what the United States really means. It's not an elite. It's not a concept of some just having some good leaders. You'll get the good leaders when you polemicize with them on the basis of the fact that you're building up a mass movement and you're generating a new generation of leaders that's coming in, kick their ass, and get our world out of this mess right now. We're coming in with a new generation of leaders, and they're already developing right before your eyes.
That's what we're seeing with the LaRouche Youth Movement, and help them out, send funds in, and get the platform around. Call us at 888-347-3258. Jonathan, thank you very much, and members of the LIM panel, thank you, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.